Have you ever been sitting at your desk, perfectly focused, maybe in the middle of writing an email or reading a report, when suddenly your computer starts sounding like a jet engine taking off on the runway?
Oh, yeah. It's so jarring.
Right. Just out of nowhere, the fans spin up to maximum overdrive, and the aluminum chassis of your laptop gets like hot enough to fry an egg.
And I think the most maddening part is that you haven't even intentionally done anything to cause it. You're just staring at a static screen, but
Yo.
just wondering what invisible ghost is possessing your machine.
Exactly. So you do the natural thing. You open up your system monitor to see what's going on, hoping for just, a simple
It's a
answer.
single culprit.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, you are immediately hit with this overwhelming, completely unreadable wall of data. I mean, hundreds of rows of background processes just bouncing around, and half of them have names that don't make any logical sense whatsoever.
Right. It is remarkably similar to, say, trying to find one specific leaky pipe in a massive skyscraper, and the building manager just hands you the raw, unedited architectural blueprints for the entire city block.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a great way to put it.
Like, the data is all there, but the sheer volume of it completely obfuscates the utility. You really just want to know where the water is coming from.
Yes. And that brings us to what we're looking at today. We're pulling from this really highly detailed engineering blog post for this deep dive. It's by a developer, an engineering leader, actually, who got so completely fed up with these runaway background processes hogging his Mac that he decided to just build his own solution from
Which
scratch.
is such a developer thing to do, right?
Totally. But this deep dive isn't just about a neat piece of utility tech. It's really an exploration into how strict constraints actually shape brilliant product design and why building things yourself, especially when you're managing hundreds of engineers by day, is a really vital exercise in staying honest. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to truly appreciate the journey this developer went on, we really need to understand the inherent tension between complex operating systems and human usability.
Right, because those are often at odds.
Exactly. A developer usually starts with a pure, uncompromised vision for how a tool should work. But modern platforms, especially macOS, they have incredibly strict system rules embedded into their architecture.
So it's not a blank canvas.
Not at all. And what we are about to see is a fascinating battle between a developer's perfectly rational desire for system visibility and Apple's ironclad, non-negotiable security sandbox.
Okay, I love this. Let's start by looking at the actual crime scene on his Mac, because I think it paints a perfect picture of modern computing. The fans are screaming, and he finally digs into what is causing it. And the culprits are basically a who's who of modern AI development tools.
Yeah, it's so typical for right now.
Right. For starters, he mentions having a couple of Claude code sessions running deep in different terminal windows.
Yeah, and he also found a local AI model resident in his memory, which was managed by a framework called a Llama.
Right, a Llama. And for anyone unfamiliar with that, a Llama basically allows developers to run heavy AI models locally on their own actual hardware rather than in the cloud.
Exactly. He had set this up specifically so an AI agent could review his code changes without him having to send sensitive proprietary code off the machine to a cloud server.
Which makes total sense for security. But on top of that, there was an old llama.cpp experiment, which is another local AI framework that he had simply forgotten to shut down.
We've all been there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and another background agent just grinding through routine dependency updates. But I have to say, the wildest offender to me was the situation he described as headless Chrome.
Ah, headless Chrome. That is a classic symptom of modern web development.
Can you explain what that actually means, like headless?
Sure. So a headless browser is a browser running without a graphical user interface. There's no window to look at. In his case, a Chrome process owned by no living parent application had quietly hijacked his system as the default link handler.
Wait, really? How does that even happen?
It's just a misconfiguration, really. But the result was that every single time he clicked a URL anywhere on his computer, it was silently opening a new invisible browser tab in the background. It was just consuming memory and CPU cycles without ever showing him a window.
That is bonkers. It is the perfect storm of invisible background compute.
It really is. But the crucial point he makes here is that none of these programs were actually misbehaving. They weren't viruses or malware.
Right, they were just doing exactly what he asked them to do.
Precisely. They were doing exactly the intensive jobs he had given them. The problem was that his computer had become so capable of running background tasks that he lost the ability to see the big picture.
And macOS's built-in activity monitor was completely failing to help him regain that visibility, right?
Yeah, because Activity Monitor is designed by Apple to be perfectly comprehensive. It shows everything, every single tiny process.
Which sounds good in theory.
In theory, yes. But when you ask the question, "What is my Mac doing right now?" and the system hands you 400 rows of processes, including, and this is real, 14 separate rows, literally just named Google Chrome Helper Renderer.
Yeah, that's just not helpful.
Right. It is failing its primary user objective. It is prioritizing raw telemetry over human legibility.
It totally reminds me of asking someone for the definition of one specific word, and they respond by dropping an unabridged 10-pound dictionary on your desk.
That's exactly what it feels like.
Like, technically, sure, they gave you the answer, but they also gave you a massive chore. You want the definition, not the whole dictionary.
The signal-to-noise ratio is just broken at that point. The application is telling the truth, but in a language that requires way too much cognitive effort to parse, especially in a moment of frustration.
Right. So his solution was elegantly simple. He decided to build a menu bar app that answered the real question at a single glance. And he gave himself a really strict limit. He called it 10 rows.
Ten rows. I love that constraint.
Yeah. He only wanted to see the top 10 CPU consumers and the top 10 memory consumers. And he wanted those processes collapse under the actual application name you would recognize. And finally, he wanted a button to stop the runaways. That is it.
And he built it using SwiftUI's Menuer Extra, targeting macOS 14 and Swift 6, which is important because Swift 6 enforces very strict concurrency checking to prevent data races.
So it's very modern, very safe code.
Exactly. But I think the most striking design choice was to keep the user interface deliberately boring.
Boring is good sometimes.
Yes, he rejected fancy animated graphs. He didn't want it living in the dock. The focus was entirely on making the data instantly readable. No third-party analytics, no network access, just a pure silent monitor.
And the irony of how he kicked off this project is just incredible to me. To write the engineering brief for this app, the app he is building specifically to hunt down and kill runaway AI processes, he used an AI agent.
It's too perfect.
Right. He used Claude Code to help draft the requirements. The very tools that buried his machine in invisible tasks helped him build the watcher that would police them.
What's fascinating here is the parallel he draws between his day job as an engineering leader and this weekend side project.
Why so?
Well, he manages hundreds of human engineers, meaning he has spent a decade writing concise, one-page strategy briefs. And it turns out that is the exact training required to successfully prompt an AI agent.
Oh, because they need that same level of clarity.
Exactly. An AI is an incredibly unforgiving reader. If you feed it vague sentences, it will confidently give you back very vague software.
That makes a lot of sense. So he gets this crisp engineering brief, he fires up Xcode, starts building, and then immediately runs headfirst into a concrete wall. Apple's App Sandbox.
Ah, yes. The sandbox. If you want to distribute an app on the Mac App Store, it is absolutely mandatory that it lives inside the app sandbox.
And what exactly does that limit for a developer?
Well, it's an extremely restricted, isolated environment. It's designed to prevent malicious software from accessing your personal data or tampering with other programs. And the sandbox has incredibly strong opinions about whether one process should ever be allowed to snoop on the resource usage of another process.
Which is literally the entire point of his app.
Exactly. Now, a lot of developers might just start blindly writing code and hoping it compiles, but he did something very methodical.
Right, before writing the actual app, he created a document called sandboxnotes.md, which I love. It's like a detective's notebook.
It really is. He ran what developers call a feasibility spike. He systematically tested every relevant system call against every type of process on his Mac and wrote down the exact error codes that the operating system spit back at him.
And those error numbers are called ERNO, right? In
Yeah.
C and Unix-based systems.
Yes, ERNO. By running this spike, he let the physics of the operating system dictate the boundaries of his product. He discovered exactly what the sandbox permits.
Like what? What did he find?
For instance, using a system call known as SICKTEL, a sandboxed app is allowed to read the overall list of running processes, so you can see what's there.
Okay, that's a start.
Right. And if a process belongs to your user account, an API called PROCBITINFO will happily report how many CPU ticks it is consuming and its resident memory size.
Okay, but wait, what happens if the process is owned by the root system? Or maybe, I don't know, a background daemon run by another user account on that same physical machine?
They are completely invisible to a sandboxed app. The kernel just silently blocks the request.
Wow. Which leads to a massive compromise right out of the gate. He originally wanted his app to show the exact same memory metric that Apple's activity monitor shows, a metric called physical footprint.
Right, the gold standard for memory metrics.
But when he tested the specific API required to get that physical footprint data, it returned an EEPROM error, permission denied, for every single process on the machine, except his own little menu bar app.
He was completely locked out of matching Activity Monitor's memory column.
So what do you do then? Just give up?
No, and this is the brilliant part. Instead of fighting the platform or filing a radar bug report with Apple or looking for some fragile private API hack, he just settled on reporting a different metric called residence size.
Ah, so he just adapted.
He documented the EEPROM error in his notes, transforming what could be a potential open bug into a settled, permanent product decision.
I have to play devil's advocate for a second here, though. If I own the computer, why can't a utility tool I voluntarily install see the real memory footprint of the apps running on my own machine?
I mean, isn't a sandbox supposed to protect the user?
Just fair question.
Right. At what point is a system trading away too much developer power just to maintain the illusion of absolute safety?
It is a profound philosophical debate in software engineering, but Apple's stance is that a single malicious app downloaded from the App Store shouldn't be able to map out your entire system state.
Even if you wanted to. But if we connect this back to his role as an engineering leader, his approach to the sandbox is just brilliant. By replacing his own frustrations with actual measurable errors, by literally letting the Erno dictate the boundaries, he settles the internal argument.
It takes the emotion out of it.
Exactly. He notes that measured constraints are fundamentally better than aspirational ones. Once you know exactly where the concrete wall is, you stop bruising your shoulder trying to walk through it, and you start building a really nice room inside those dimensions.
That's a great way to look at it. But getting the raw data out of the sandbox was really only half the battle. Because once he forced the system to hand over the telemetry, he realized the data itself was incredibly hostile to human eyeballs.
Oh, absolutely.
He had to bridge the gap between how a kernel thinks and how a human being thinks.
Because raw system data is rarely designed for legibility. The kernel of an operating system doesn't deal in nice, neat application names like Safari or Final Cut Pro.
Right, doesn't care about branding.
No, it deals in process names. And in macOS, those process names are strictly limited to 16 characters.
Okay, hang on. Why would an operating system intentionally handicap its own data by permanently chopping the names off at 16 characters? That seems incredibly short-sighted today.
It does now, yeah. But it is a legacy constraint rooted deep in the history of Unix, specifically a constant called Max Comlin.
Max Comlin.
Right. Decades ago, memory was precious, and the kernel needed a tiny fixed-size C string to quickly identify processes without allocating variable memory. And that architecture still exists under the hood of modern macOS.
So basically a fossil.
A living fossil, yeah. So the kernel hands you 16 characters, a numerical process ID, and expects you to be happy with it.
Ah, which explains why Activity Monitor was showing him absolute gibberish like Google Chrome instead of Google Chrome Helper. It literally couldn't fit the rest of the letters into the kernel's memory slot.
Precisely. And this is where raw data just fails the user test.
So to solve this, he had to write a custom layer of pure Swift logic to act as a translator. And this logic, it takes a chaotic, truncated process name, and it walks up what developers call its parent PICKID ancestry.
Right, tracing the lineage.
Yeah. It essentially traces the process's family tree upward until it finds the actual known application that spawned it. And once it finds the parent, it strips away all those useless suffixes like helper or renderer and groups them all together under the main app's name.
That translation layer is really the secret sauce. As he points out, the gap between raw, truncated processes and recognizable applications is where the actual product lives.
I picture it kind of like trying to organize a massive chaotic family reunion. Like if you have 50 individuals running around a park yelling over each other, it's completely overwhelming. You don't know who belongs to who.
It's a noise.
Exactly. But if you walk around and group them by family name, putting all the Smiths at one table and all the Joneses at another, suddenly you can look at the field and know exactly which family is eating all the potato salad.
That grouping logic is exactly what turns a sea of data into actionable intelligence. I mean, a perfectly accurate system monitor showing all 50 fragmented Chrome processes is useless because it carries an immense cognitive load.
Nobody wants to read that.
Right. Users do not want a more accurate process table. They want a simple answer to the question, What is currently consuming my machine?
Okay, so the logic was clean, the sandbox constraints were mapped, and the 16-character limit was solved. But building flawless logic doesn't mean much if the data you're feeding it suddenly corrupts.
No, it doesn't.
Which brings us to the moment he actually ran the app, and the messy reality of live bugs just reared its head. He documents three specific bugs that made it into a running build, and they only revealed themselves because he was using the tool in real time under heavy load.
Which highlights a really crucial lesson in software development. Some architectural flaws will never show up in a unit test or a simulated lab environment. They only manifest when the metal gets hot.
Right. So the first one was the CPU bug. He was looking at his slick new menu bar app, and it was telling him that a standard background process was using thousands of percent of the CPU, which is physically impossible.
Unless you have 20 processors strapped together.
Right. So why did that happen?
This happened because of how Swift handles concurrent asynchronous tasks, specifically a mechanism called an actor hop.
An actor hop.
Yes. In Swift, an actor is basically a way to isolate data so multiple threads don't crash into each other trying to read or write at the same time. But moving execution in and out of that safe room, the actor hop takes a tiny fraction of a microsecond.
But under heavy system load, when the CPU is thrashing.
Exactly. That microsecond transition gets delayed. He was capturing the timestamp of the CPU tick before passing the work into the actor. Because the system was stressed, the data sat in a queue waiting to enter the actor. By the time it was processed, the elapsed time between his data samples had essentially shrunk down to almost zero.
And if you remember high school math, if you divide accrued CPU ticks by a number approaching zero,
The result explodes.
so the math blows up, producing a CPU reading in the thousands of percent.
Yeah, and the fix wasn't just a simple patch. It required establishing a new architectural rule. The actor itself must own the clock. It has to take the timestamp from inside the safe room at the exact moment it sweeps the data.
Wow, that is such a subtle timing issue. Okay, so the second bug was a UI issue. Because he was using Menu Bar Extra to draw the interface, the app would open, measure the size of the window once before the list of processes had actually fetched their data, and then stubbornly refuse to resize itself.
So he just ended up staring at a tiny empty popover window.
Yeah, super frustrating. But to fix that, he had to invert the UI dependency. Instead of letting the dynamic data dictate the window size, he gave the list region a fixed, uncompromising height. Whether it holds 0 rows while loading or 10 rows when full, it takes up the exact same amount of vertical space on the screen.
It's a smart, simple fix.
Yeah. And the third bug was purely a developer's headache. Because he was constantly compiling and relaunching the app to test changes, he'd end up with multiple ghost copies of the app icon just cluttering up his menu bar.
I hate when that happens.
Right. He fixed it by having the app broadcast a takeover notice over Apple's distributed notification center. So whenever a new, fresh instance launches, it yells out to the entire system, "I'm here!" And any old zombified instances hear that broadcast and quietly quit themselves.
It's very elegant. Squashing bugs is satisfying, but he also wanted to add a specific feature that forced him to dive into the absolute basement of the operating system. He wanted a ports feature.
Yes. Because another massive source of runaway compute for developers are these forgotten web servers or database ports left open in the background. You wanted to see exactly which app was listening on which network port.
But the sandbox threw that exact same EEPROM permission denied error when he tried standard tools like LSolve.
So his workaround was incredibly intense. To bypass the sandbox restrictions, he had to ask the kernel for the entire TCP and UDP routing tables using raw systols, and then he had to manually parse the raw ISNU headers.
Yeah.
Let's pause there because parsing ISNU headers sounds completely miserable. Why is that such a heavy lift?
Because it means abandoning all of Apple's nice, modern, safe, Swift programming tools. You are essentially reading the raw, unfiltered binary memory layouts of the operating system. These are structures that were originally written in C decades ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have to unpack the bytes exactly as the kernel emits them. It is gritty, unglamorous, low-level plumbing.
So what does this all mean? Like, why would someone who leads hundreds of engineers by day, who has large teams to do this kind of intricate coding for him, put himself through the absolute misery of parsing raw kernel memory headers on a weekend side project?
Because it keeps his engineering judgment honest.
How so?
It is far too easy for leadership to drift away from the reality of the metal. When you spend your days in strategy meetings, software starts to look easy.
Right, you're just drawing boxes on a whiteboard.
Exactly. But shipping these apps yourself, encountering bizarre concurrency bugs, dealing with esoteric kernel headers, it prevents your technical muscles from atrophying. When he returns to his day job and has asked his engineering teams to accept a difficult platform constraint or accelerate a timeline, he knows exactly what that software building actually costs in blood, sweat, and syntax.
He's a better leader because he still feels the friction of the stack.
Exactly.
And speaking of friction, the original goal of this entire endeavor hits the hardest wall imaginable, the unshippable feature. The whole reason he started building this app was to create a kill switch. He wanted to identify an orphaned AI process, click a button in his menu bar, and terminate it instantly.
And here is where the app sandbox dropped the hammer. It flatly, categorically denies terminating another process.
He tried everything, didn't he?
He did. He tried the polite AppKit request to ask the app to quit. He tried sending a raw POSIX signal, which is a low-level OS command, to force kill a process. He even tried routing commands through AppleScript. Every single attempt failed, throwing a permission error. He measured each failure and logged it.
But instead of taking to a developer forum to complain about Apple's draconian rules, his reaction was entirely different.
This raises an important question. What if the sandbox isn't just a nuisance? What if the sandbox is actually right?
Wait, really?
Yeah, the author realized that the security model of a modern OS dictates that an application downloaded from a public store should never be allowed to act as a system assassin, arbitrarily killing other software on your machine.
Oh, when you put it like that, it makes complete sense.
The security model was the correct answer, not an obstacle to be hacked around.
So he made a fascinating product compromise. He physically split the application into two separate editions, controlled by a single compile time flag in his code. Edition one is the Mac App Store edition. It is fully sandboxed, it plays by all of Apple's rules, and it functions strictly as a read-only monitor. No kill switch.
Right. And edition two is the direct edition. This is a version you download straight from his website. It is unsandboxed, signed directly with his developer ID. And because it operates completely outside the sandbox walls, it features the force quit button.
Plus, it shows the true physical memory stats that match activity monitor, right?
Yep. And it manages its own software updates. One singular code base, generating two completely different realities based entirely on the constraints of the distribution platform.
That is so smart. But the constraints didn't just come from the code, they came from Apple's human review board, too. Here's where it gets really interesting. He originally named his app Mac Headroom. It was a proud, deliberate pun on Mac's headroom, you know, the glitchy, stuttering, synthetic TV host from the 1980s.
Oh, I remember.
He felt a Mac being overrun by chattering AI processes deserved the joke.
But Apple App Review rejected it. Their guideline 5.2.5 states very clearly that third-party developers cannot put the word Mac in a product name to avoid trademark confusion.
Right, so he had to rename the app to System Headroom, though he stubbornly kept the mashedroom.com domain name for the website. But what I loved most was his reaction to the rejection. He actually found it refreshing.
Well, in his day job as a leader, he is constantly the one reviewing other people's architecture and handing down findings and corrections. He noted that it was actually deeply healthy to have a finding land in his own inbox for once, and to just accept it, fix the naming issue, and move on.
Just exactly as he asks his own engineers to do every single day.
Precisely.
Which brings us to the grand takeaway of this whole deep dive. He writes this beautiful summarizing line at the end of his post. He says, "The sandbox never shrank this app. It drew the floor plan."
That is a great line.
Right. Every single constraint that initially looked like an annoying obstacle ended up driving a distinct, concrete product decision.
The divergence in memory metrics, the complex grouping logic required to bypass the 16-character limit, the incredibly gritty implementation for network ports, and the ultimate decision to split the app into two separate distribution editions.
None of that happens without the constraints pushing back against his initial ideas.
Exactly. When you build on someone else's platform, you have to measure the walls, write down the errors, and let the platform tell you what the honest, shippable version of your idea actually is.
And there is such a universally valuable lesson in that mindset for all of us, whether you write Swift code or not. When you face a strict limitation in your own life, maybe a measured no from a boss at work, or a brutally tight budget on a creative project, or a platform rule you just can't bypass, recognizing that boundary isn't a defeat.
No, it's really not.
It can actually relieve you of the paralyzing burden of infinite choices.
The limitations define the shape of the solution. They force clarity.
Exactly. Which brings us back to where we started. Your computer sounds like a jet engine. You open the monitor, and you're drowning in an overwhelming wall of unstructured data. He fixed his wall of data by embracing strict
He
boundaries.
really did.
It leaves you wondering if strict artificial constraints like Apple's App Sandbox can force clearer, more intentional, and highly usable software design. What sandboxes or artificial boundaries should we be intentionally placing around our own daily routines or our information diets to prevent our own cognitive overload?